Chapter 11. Gull Island, 25 miles from the coast of Mississippi. The immense aircraft sat on the water, sheltered by a barrier island only 25 miles from the Mississippi shoreline. Though it was at rest for the moment, the plane seemed poised for flight, its nose aimed seaward, its outstretched wings reaching for the wind like a great mechanical albatross yearning to fly. The aircraft was called the Monarch. It was nearly the size of a 747, though shorter from front to back and wider in cross-section. It had a squat, flat-bottomed fuselage that fanned out like the hull of a boat, its wings attached at the top, drooping slightly and supported at the tips by torpedo-shaped floats. Six turbofan engines were nestled in the top of the wings instead of hanging beneath, a design that prevented them from taking in the spray generated by the body of the plane as it landed and took off from the water. The twin tails soared higher than they might have needed to, but the extra height made it easier to control the aircraft, both on the water and in the air. The Monarch was a triumph of engineering, the only plane of its kind, the creation of Tessa Franco, a wealthy and brilliant designer who'd been called a modern-day Howard Hughes. The comparison was meant as both compliment and put-down, hinting at creativity, recklessness, and possible madness. Tessa, who with her dark hair, smoky eyes, and continental beauty seemed more likely to be found on the red carpet at Cannes than in an engineer lab, responded to the comparison by pointing out that she was neither male, nor mad, nor generally reclusive, though she was otherwise quite content to be compared to the adventurous and innovative billionaire. Sitting in her plush office in the forward part of the aircraft's upper deck, she divided her attention between the light of dusk that came through the window and the flat-screen monitor in front of her. Staring back at her from the screen was the square face of a powerfully built man with a dark mustache. His name was Eret Buron. Buron was a shadowy but important player in the oil business, with extensive holdings in Kazakhstan and other areas of Central Asia. He and Tessa had a long and complicated relationship. Business and pleasure might not have been a good mix, but lust, greed, and the desire for power were aphrodisiacs both of them enjoyed. Their latest collaboration was the riskiest of all, and as such, the most enticing. "My dear Tessa," Buron said, "you look ravishing as always. I trust you're feeling well."
"I'll feel better when I've been paid," Tessa said. "I've done my part. I promised you and your consortium rising oil prices, and I've delivered. Now I expect the consortium to transfer the funds we've agreed upon."
"Oil prices have been rising," Buron admitted, "though at a very slow pace."
"That will change by morning," she replied. He tilted his head.
"Surely you're not claiming the disaster in the Gulf as evidence of your success."
It wasn't exactly success, but she had every right to claim it. She felt it necessary to explain. "The U.S. government has been keeping oil prices artificially depressed, even as I've succeeded in sabotaging production around the world. With this incident playing on TV and soon appearing on the cover of every magazine in the world, they won't be able to keep prices down much longer. You'll have your windfall, and I will take what was promised me." Aggression was her nature. Some men responded to it. Others were put off by it. Buron was a man who preferred control, but he also savored a challenge. It had made their romantic relationship fiery, combative, and exhilarating. On the screen, Buron paused before responding to her demands. He shifted in his chair, gently stroking his mustache, smoothing out the bristly surface.
"You and I have known each other a long time now, Tessa. It was I who helped you complete that great aircraft of yours, and I who convinced the consortium that you could do the impossible and change the world's oil market once and for all. But such a claim must be proven before it can be paid."
More equivocating, she thought, more delays. Delays that were driving her toward bankruptcy. Buron continued.
"The requirement is for a long-term sustained rise in prices. One that would make the consortium the most powerful oil cartel in the world. and simultaneously allow your company to become the largest alternative energy firm in the world. Divide and conquer, you said. You get your half of the planet, and we get ours. Isn't that how you sold it to me?
It was, she said, and that's exactly how it will be. But I can't finish the job without more working capital.
Buran sighed. Tessa, you spend money faster than anyone I know. In hopes that this is your last request for an advance, I'm willing to extend to you an additional installment, but you'll have to agree to reduce your final payment by a third.
The condescension left her seething, but all that really mattered were the numbers. Trade billions for a few million? I think not. He shrugged.
I told the others you wouldn't accept it, but I was obliged to make the offer. Unfortunately, that means we have nothing further to talk about, at least until it's clear that the price of oil will continue to get higher and remain so indefinitely into the future.
You're weakening your own position by weakening me, she said.
You're anything but weak, Buran said with a smile. I suspect you'll have the world wrapped around your finger soon enough. Contact me when the conditions are irrefutably changed, and I shall trumpet your achievements to the consortium.
The screen went dark. Tessa looked out the window at the smoke marring the dusky horizon. She felt certain that the market conditions were turning in her favor. Soon enough, Buran and his consortium would be throwing money at her. And not only them. Other investors, other companies, even powerful world governments. They'd be climbing all over one another to throw money at her. The hardest part would be deciding just how much to accept, and from whom. Tessa turned her attention to a second flat screen. It displayed the view outside the plane. A commotion in the water had frightened away a pair of the gulls that gave the island its name. As the birds flapped madly and propelled themselves into flight, a disc-shaped craft surfaced behind the plane. About time, she said to herself. Without delay, Tessa got up and left the office. Striding through the aircraft, she traveled down a hall, passing her master's suite and a control room behind the cockpit. A ladder took her to the middle deck, which held space for entertaining, including a marvelous lounge and a workout center where Tessa spent much of her time. Another ladder took her to the lowest deck, with its unadorned metal decks and gray-painted walls. She walked aft along this deck, passing multiple vehicles, including a black Mercedes SUV and a silver Ferrari. Behind them were several ATVs, a pair of jet skis, and two powerboats with large outboard engines. Beyond the boats lay the tail end of the plane, which was comprised of a large door that lowered and doubled as a ramp. It was locked in the down position, and two men wearing waders were standing halfway down the ramp up to their knees in water as they attached cables to the craft she'd seen on camera. As it was pulled on board, the sleek disc revealed itself in detail. It had no conning tower or control fins to speak of, just various vents and panels that opened and closed to direct water across and through its hull, allowing it to pitch, roll, and even rotate in any direction. It was powered by water jets instead of propellers, and a pair of bubble canopies on the top that resembled eyes covered the occupants. All was not well, however, as Tessa noticed mechanical damage on the aft end of the hull and scrape marks near the nose. As the craft was secured, one of the canopies opened and a man with peroxide blonde hair popped out. He was fit and muscular and looked to be in his mid-30s. His face was angry and drawn. What happened?
There were problems, he said.
I can see that, she replied. Did you manage to get rid of the incubators?
The first set of the tankers were destroyed in the initial explosion, Volk said. The other tankers were still in place. I used the explosives to destroy them. There's nothing but scrap metal on the bottom now. The tanks, the incubators, the injection systems, all of it has been obliterated.
And what happened to the discus, she said, pointing to the damage on the submarine's hull.
Volk glanced at the scrapes. I ran into some resistance down there. Another submersible.
From the oil company?
Volk shook his head. No. It had a Numa logo plastered on the side.
Tessa paused at that. She'd spent much of the last few years studying the design of submersibles, the methods used to build and recover things from the bottom of the sea. Numa was very well known to her. Their presence concerned her. What were they doing there?
I couldn't tell you, Falk said, but you needn't worry. I dropped one of the magnetized charges on their hull. Whoever was operating that sub is now waiting in line at the pearly gates.
Done explaining himself, Volk jumped down and supervised the loading and storing of the discus. As he worked, another of her crewmen walked up the ramp. He was a burly man with a scruffy red beard. His name was Woodrich. They called him Woods. He differed in appearance from Volk, big, lumbering, earthy, nothing polished about him. But he was a fanatical environmentalist, and his devotion to the eradication of fossil fuels had been very useful to her so far.
That fire is spewing poison all across the Gulf, Woods said. That's not what we came here to do.
Consider it creative destruction, she replied. Sometimes you need to burn down the old world before you build a new one. Woods could be as aggressive as Volk, but he tended to simmer quietly for a long time before blowing. For now, he held his tongue. That was enough for her.
Get everything secured down here, she said, forcing them to work together. And make it quick. We're leaving.
As Volk and Woods went to work securing the submarine, Tessa made her way to the cockpit. The pilots were there, ready and waiting. Time to go, she said. 10 minutes later, the engines were roaring, and the Monarch was accelerating along the smooth water behind Gull Island. As it picked up speed, the aircraft rode higher in the water, until only the very bottom of the keel was skimming the surface. All at once, it pulled free, soaring into the sky, and shedding a trail of mist behind it.